It's December 28th. Good Friday to you. Thanks for listening to Minnesota's News on the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi. Today on the podcast, His Honor will step aside after running Minneapolis for a decade. A grieving father is charged in the accidental handgun death of his young son. Farmers are apparently increasingly digging up old cemeteries. And Minnesotans are still keeping food shelves hopping. First, Minneapolis voters will elect the city's first new mayor in more than 10 years. Incumbent R.T. Ryback has announced he will not seek a fourth term. His announcement will unleash a flood of pent-up political ambition. Candidates are already lining up to take Ryback's place. But Curtis Gilbert reports Ryback's decision also leaves questions about what he will do next.
Ryback says he still loves being mayor of Minneapolis.
This job thrills me and it still gives me goosebumps.
But after more than a decade leading the state's biggest city, Ryback says he's ready to restore some balance to his life and his family's. Ryback points out there are other ways to make a difference in the world besides being mayor.
There are people all over this city, every day, who do big things and small things as private citizens to make this a better place. I've been one of those people before, and I'm going to be one of those again.
But exactly what Ryback will do once he finishes his final year as mayor remains uncertain. He was active in President Obama's reelection campaign, and it's possible there could be a job for him in Washington. Ryback didn't rule out an administration job, but he says it's more likely he'll stay in Minnesota. 2 years ago, he ran for governor. He says he'd still consider running for that office, but Ryback acknowledges he'll have to be patient.
The governor is the one other job that I would run for, but I don't expect that'll be open for 6 years. I expect the governor to run again. And maybe I'll be in a walker by the time it's open. I may still be interested, but we'll just have to see then.
With DFL incumbents holding every statewide office, Ryback's political options are limited for now. There aren't a lot of places to move up. But now that Ryback's planning to move out of the mayor's office, there are plenty of Minneapolis politicians interested in taking his place. City Council member Gary Schiff is considering a run, and he knows he's not the only one.
I think anytime you see a once-in-a-generation moment like this when there is an empty seat, you'll see a lot of people stepping forward who really believe in Minneapolis and really believe in public service and have a lot to give.
Schiff says he'll decide next month whether to jump in the race. Others made up their minds immediately.
My name is Betsy Hodges. I am on the Minneapolis City Council.
And?
I am running for mayor.
Hodges formed an exploratory committee last month so she could raise and spend money to run for mayor, but she vowed to drop out if Ryback decided to run again. Former City Council member Jackie Cherry Holmes is on vacation in Hawaii, but yesterday her mind was on Minneapolis too.
A number of people have talked to me and encouraged me to run, and when I get back in town, I'll be establishing a formal campaign committee and getting in the race.
School board member Hussein Samatar is thinking about running too, but he never would have run against Ryback either.
If he reverses tonight and he says tomorrow he wants to be the mayor, I will be the first to show up to volunteer.
Mayor Ryback says he considered the crowd of candidates eager to replace him when he made his announcement yesterday, more than a year before the end of his term. He wanted to give them lots of time to campaign, something he needed when he first ran for mayor in 2001.
I was not known at all, and I went into the summer with about a 20% name approval rating. And elections in this city are really won person-to-person, door-to-door, and that takes a long time. And I want to make sure door-to-door candidates have a chance to.
And with Ryback out of the race, there will be plenty of candidates going door-to-door next year in Minneapolis.
Curtis Gilbert there in Minneapolis. That's the city at the heart of Hennepin County. And the county attorney's office has charged a Minneapolis man with two felonies in the accidental shooting death of his two-year-old son. Earlier this month, Ning Yao Shong died after he was accidentally shot by his four-year-old brother. According to the charges filed yesterday, the boy's father, 31-year-old Cao Zhang, left several guns within reach of the children. Here's Brant Williams.
Minneapolis police say they found a total of 8 guns in Cao Xiong's South Minneapolis 2-bedroom home, 4 rifles and 4 semi-automatic pistols. The criminal complaint says police found some of the guns stored in taped boxes in a laundry basket on a closet floor and others in a duffel bag in a closet. They say some guns were secured in cases, some were not. One semi-automatic pistol was located in a case in a kitchen cabinet on top of drinking glasses. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman says the gun used to accidentally shoot Ningyao Xiang was wedged between the mattress and pillows of the bed in the master bedroom. He says the safety on that gun was not working.
No self-respecting gun owner would have a handgun in such a condition available to kids. That is a crime.
Xiang was charged with second-degree manslaughter and endangerment of a child. The first charge carries a maximum penalty of up to 10 years in prison and or a $20,000 fine. Endangerment of a child can bring a prison sentence of up to 5 years or a $10,000 fine. Freeman says the case is difficult to prosecute because Xiang has already paid a heavy price, the loss of a child.
And yet, we have rules. And the rules about having locked guns and unloaded guns and safeties on guns and having guns that aren't available to kids are good laws.
According to the complaint, Xiang told police that he owns guns for hunting, and he says he has a permit to carry a gun but couldn't carry the semi-automatic pistol to his job at a mental health clinic. Xiang told police that on the day of the shooting, he tucked the gun behind the mattress in the bedroom, a place where he'd never stored the gun before. He says he was home for lunch at the time of the shooting. Assistant Minneapolis Police Chief Matthew Clark says the death of the young boy was a tragedy that could have been prevented.
We understand that the family is grieving, and it's a severe loss for them and for the community to lose a child. We want to make it very clear that it is the responsibility of every gun owner to secure their weapons and make sure that they're locked, and that's especially true when you have children in your home.
The shooting is similar to another incident in St. Paul earlier this year. However, in that case, a toddler who was accidentally shot by a sibling survived. The boy's father pleaded guilty to a gross misdemeanor of negligent storage of a firearm. An NPR News analysis of state court data shows prosecuting parents for leaving guns around kids is rare, but not unprecedented in Minnesota. Since 2001, about 85 people in the state have been convicted of one of two potential charges in this kind of case. Both apply to adults who leave unsecured, loaded firearms within the reach of a child. The more serious charge considers this an act of child endangerment or neglect because it could substantially harm or lead to the death of the child. About a third of all these convictions were prosecuted in Hennepin County.
Brant Williams there in Minneapolis. A Minnesota farmer could face felony charges for destroying an old pioneer cemetery. The case is under investigation in Grant County. Dan Gunderson has more on the case and a look at the growing number of neglected cemeteries across the state.
The Berner Family Cemetery in Grant County was established in 1872. The last burial was in 1892. The cemetery remained a small island in the middle of a farm field until about a month ago. That's when Grant County Sheriff Dwight Walvotny got a call.
From a family member who said that they had an old pioneer cemetery out in the middle of a section east of Herman there, and that the trees were now gone. And they suspected maybe somebody pushed those trees down and removed grave markers.
Walvotny says investigators went to the field with a search warrant and found only a few fragments of headstones. They also noticed debris had been buried in the field.
So what we did, we come in with another search warrant a few days later and dug up the hole because we wanted to save, you know, the evidence there, the grave markers. And we did find several of them in that hole.
Walvotny says the farmer admitted clearing the cemetery and he's cooperating with the investigation. Walvotny says investigators will return to the site in the spring to look carefully for any sign that bones were dug up. The county attorney says it could be several weeks before he decides on charges in the case. Damaging a cemetery can be a felony under Minnesota law, even if it's abandoned. Even though the farmer owns the land, the cemetery is protected. Minnesota State archaeologist Scott Anfinson says this is the most egregious case of cemetery destruction he's seen, but it's certainly not the first.
I say it's not unusual. I mean, I have three or four active ones right now, instances where farmers have either started to nibble away at a cemetery boundary or removed the headstones and plowed over the top of it.
Anfinson says in one case, a farmer simply piled the headstones in a ditch and plowed up the cemetery. He says as farm equipment gets larger, farmers have a more difficult time maneuvering around obstacles. Anfinson says in the Grant County case, he was told the farmer thought the cemetery was abandoned.
Maybe no one had been out there for 10 years, and he finally said, well, no one will notice, and it's really a hassle for me to plow around this, but it's still against the law.
The Berner Family Cemetery was a special place for Scott Berner. He grew up in Grant County. He now lives in the Twin Cities. Berner says he didn't visit often because he needed to ask the landowner for permission to cross a farm field to get to the cemetery. He describes it as a peaceful place with lilac bushes and a towering cottonwood tree. Berner says when he learned the cemetery had been bulldozed, it felt like a death in the family.
Because every time that I drove past it before this, you know, I would look out and I'd see the grove of trees, and I'm like, okay, there's our cemetery. That's where, you know, Frederick and Christine are buried and their grandchildren. And you just, you know, you felt, there it is, and, you know, everything's fine. But it was difficult to drive by after. It was not a good thing to see.
Berner says when he visited the family plot, he often wondered why it was located in the middle of a farm field, nearly a mile from the family homestead.
Why did they pick that site? There had to be something special about it at the time. And I think about that. It was special at that time. It's still special today. It should be there to be special to future generations. There's something about it.
There are thousands of small cemeteries across the state. The state archaeologist recently compiled a list of more than 6,000 cemeteries. About 3,000 are unrecorded. That means there's no official record, but they're still protected. State archaeologist Scott Anfinson says, as small country churches close, more cemeteries are neglected and abandoned every year. The law says townships or counties can care for those cemeteries, but Anfinson says with tight budgets, no one wants the extra work. He's been trying to think of a solution.
Maybe we should start and adopt a cemetery program. I mean, if we can keep our highways clean, maybe we can start helping the cemeteries, which are important, and everybody recognizes their not only their historic value, but their spiritual value and just the family value.
Anfinson says he'd like to see state law not only protect burial sites, but ensure they are cared for in the future.
Dan Gunderson in Morehead on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. After weeks of stalemate, locked out musicians of the Minnesota Orchestra and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra will return to the bargaining table next week. Ewan Kerr has more.
Both sets of negotiations are scheduled to begin Wednesday, January 2nd. Management and players at the Minnesota Orchestra have not met since September, when musicians rejected a contract calling for large pay cuts, a smaller orchestra, and extensive changes in work conditions. Management locked out players October 1st and refused to meet until musicians produced a contract counterproposal. In turn, players said they needed an independent analysis of the orchestra's finances before they could make such an offer. Management withdrew preconditions last week, and the sides have now agreed to meet. Facing a similar contract dispute, the two sides of the SPCO haven't talked since September 8th, 2 weeks after management locked out its musicians. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's Ewan Kerr. He's been following the orchestra Discord from the beginning. The DNR is opening lakes inside the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness to trout anglers 2 weeks earlier than usual. Stephanie Hemphill has more.
The DNR is trying to simplify fishing regulations. For lakes entirely inside the wilderness, the seasons for stream trout and lake trout now open on the same day, this Saturday, December 29th. For lakes partially or entirely outside the wilderness, the season won't open until January 12th. DNR Regional Fisheries Manager Tim Gaiman says the more accessible lakes benefit from a longer period of protection.
Lakes outside the Boundary Waters are a little easier to access. A couple extra weeks of fishing pressure there is probably not a good thing, and so they open just a little bit later.
All the trout seasons in the region close March 31st. Winter catch-and-release trout season in southeastern Minnesota runs January through March.
That's Stephanie Hemphill on fishing. Now Dan Crocker on fishing and hunting and bird watching. And a new study by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The survey estimates that hunting participation has increased by 9% nationwide since the last survey 5 years ago. The number of people fishing grew by 11%. Overall, nearly 38% of Americans say they took part in wildlife-related recreation. The numbers are a reversal of recent surveys, which had shown a decline in participation in these activities. In Minnesota, the number of licensed hunters and anglers has held steady in recent years, with around 1.5 million anglers and just under 600,000 hunters. But the DNR projects those numbers will start to decline because 18 to 34-year-olds are not hunting and fishing at the same rates as baby boomers. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Finally, a look at hunger in 2012. The number of people who sought help providing food for themselves and their families hit record highs this year in Minnesota. Never before have so many residents visited food shelves or relied on food stamps. But as Julie Seipel reports, those numbers are not climbing as fast as they had been in recent years.
The totals just kept rising this year. 526,000 Minnesotans on food stamps, more than 3 million visits to food shelves, more than one-third of the state's public school kids on free or reduced lunch. But as high as these numbers are, Minnesota didn't see the kind of spike among people seeking food assistance as it had in recent years. Take food shelves. After years of double-digit increases, visits rose about 1% across the state. Colleen Moriarty is the director of Hunger Solutions. She says that's progress.
It's always good news when we don't see 10% increases, because that means that there's the level of kind of panic is down, and that's what we want.
But she doesn't know why the growth was slower.
We're not sure whether that's the economy picking up or if it is just that the system has kind of had it. It's at capacity and there really isn't much more food or space for people.
To Susan Russell Freeman, who runs the Veep food shelf in Bloomington, the numbers are little comfort.
But it hasn't gone down. That's the point. It hasn't gone down.
Like many suburban food shelves, Veep was hit hard in the economic downturn. Clients now have to wait up to 5 days to get in. Veep plans to move to a larger space in the new year, and Freeman isn't surprised that they're still so busy. The food shelf serves many underemployed Minnesotans. She says it takes a while for those clients to get back on their feet.
Even though other people may see their 401ks improving, called back to more seasonal work, people who are normally underemployed will not see that recovery for a much longer time. So whenever those in the know say that our economy has recovered, I guarantee you we're 18 months behind that, if not 24.
It's not just food shelves that saw slower growth this year. The same was true of food stamps. Food stamp use rose 3% after a 12% spike last year. Erin Sullivan Sutton is the state's Assistant Commissioner of Child and Family Services. She says the numbers went up this year in part due to an outreach effort that put ads on buses and in grocery stores encouraging eligible Minnesotans to sign up for what's officially called SNAP.
We're really getting the word out to people that if you're having issues meeting your nutritional needs, consider applying for SNAP.
In fact, she hopes to see another small increase next year if it means more hungry Minnesotans are getting the help they need. Minnesota families are also signing their kids up for food help at school. Official numbers haven't been released, but state education officials predict the number of students on free or reduced lunch will be up about 2% this school year over last. Catherine Grafsgaard leads nutrition services at the South Washington County Schools, where about 16% of students receive free or reduced lunch.
You know, the last few years, it's been a little bit of alarming, a little bit of an upward swing in eligibility of free and reduced, you know, pretty much based on the economy. But now it seems to be leveling out.
It's a level of need Colleen Moriarty of Hunger Solutions worries Minnesotans will simply get used to. As a record number of people continue to seek food help, she's concerned everyone else could grow complacent.
I worry about that every day. I do. It keeps me up at night that we will just accept a certain level of people who it's okay for charity to help them feed their families, and it's not okay.
Moriarty says her goal is to see everyone working with the income and dignity to support themselves, but she still intends to ask the Minnesota legislature next session for additional support for food shelves.
That's Julie Seipel on the NPR News Update podcast. Enjoy the weekend. Minnesota's news on your schedule returns after the New Year's holiday next Wednesday. I'm Phil Picardi wishing you a very pleasant new year.